Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Welcome and thank you for tuning in. You're listening to the Beyond 50 radio program. I'm your host, Daniel Davis. Just around the corner will be a very celebrated holiday as we honor all of our veterans who have been able to be here to help fight and protect the constitutional rights and the freedoms that we enjoy here in the United States. But sometimes the question looms overhead, how much longer will we need to do this? Is the world actually outside of the United States a real threat? Or are we all just sort of in a unusual cooperative economics that causes us to believe that we need to be in war with one country or another? We're going to explore this today as we talk about the secrets of World War II. And our guest joining us here on the Beyond 50 radio program today is going to be talking about just that thing. And I'd like to welcome to our program Mr. Mark Weber. And Mark, thank you for joining us here on the program today.
Yeah, thank you, Daniel, for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Now, you know, one of the first things that come to mind when people start to become cynical about our motives when it comes to war, obviously, is our last administration and, you know, the run-up to the U.S. invasion in Iraq. And it was funny how it originally had started where we were going after the terrorist cells believed and known to be in Afghanistan and that Iraq had nothing to do with this war, but how it shifted. Now, let's go ahead and talk about that, because I've actually had colonels, majors, you name it, come on the program who were either involved with that or Desert Storm or even the wars in Vietnam, and they said, well, you know, maybe it was necessary, but there was such a mishandling of what was going on there. But let's really talk about that and get started there.
Right. Well, it's very clear that the emptiness of the claims to justify the war are shown by the fact that the reasons given to go kept on changing and shifting. At one point, it was claimed that we had to attack Iraq because somehow it was involved with 9/11 or the Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq was somehow involved with that. Many Americans still believe that the Saddam Hussein government had some sort of involvement in the 9/11 attacks. That was untrue. And although high-ranking officials gave that impression, they weren't so stupid or so culpable as to actually make that claim. The claim was also made, of course, and this is the biggest justification, that we had to attack Iraq because it had a large and very dangerous arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, and the Iraq government was determined to use them. Famously, Condoleezza Rice even said, well, whatever doubts we may have about that, we have to attack because the doubts would be clarified with a mushroom cloud over the United States. Mm-hmm. This kind of rhetoric turned out, of course, and is acknowledged even by the administration officials eventually, to be empty. Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction. In fact, Iraq was so weak that when the United States attacked in March 2003, not a single Iraqi airplane even took to the air. Iraq's military had been shattered in the first Gulf War, and of course Iraq was so weak it wasn't even able to overcome Iran in the long war that those two countries had against each other, in which, ironically, the United States supported Iraq, of all things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, this pattern of deceit to generate support in the American public for war is a very, very instructive one for the American people, and it's remarkable how few Americans have bothered even to remember or to keep in mind what happened there, because the danger exists and has existed and will exist, that the public is stampeded into new wars on the basis of false claims to get the American public to support these conflicts. And this is a very, very dangerous thing, and it requires leaders and a public that remembers these kinds of precedents in the past so that we don't fall into the same trap again and again.
Now, here's the thing, Mark. It's really quite interesting because we can set the Wayback Machine and it can go back forever, but I would prefer to focus on the United States and how we've come to be involved in wars. And here's an interesting thing. I think it was back in 2000, I want to say 1999, 2000. I was shipped a book by a publicist, and it really just astounded me what it was. It was Dr. Seuss Goes to War.
Yeah.
And here he had his commentary, of course, artwork only Dr. Seuss could get to. And you take a look within these pages. This was collected from World War I through World War II through the Vietnam War, of things that he sketched, you know, the commentary, the opines and the like. And it was quite interesting how he had basically portrayed that everybody, when it comes to the war machine, has their hands in the kettle, that there really aren't any enemies. It's like the politic of the body decides they're going to go to war, but they're positioning what seems to be for economic or financial gains. And then they use the people to basically, you know, move their agenda forward.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a long pattern of American leaders stampeding the public to war with a lot of overheated rhetoric about the great danger to the United States. You know, our generation is the generation I think could be called the disillusioned generation, because it's our generation that was very, very disillusioned over the Vietnam War. This was a real shattering experience for millions of Americans to realize, after the deaths of so many Americans, and of course even more Vietnamese, that we had been deceived about not only the origins and the nature of the conflict in Vietnam, but about the course of the war. We were kept on, we were told over and over, and I remember this vividly as when I was younger, about how everything was going better and how it was all turning out okay, with inflated and bogus statistics and figures about so-called body count of the deaths. But more than that, our leaders lied to the public about the very nature of the conflict and instead portrayed Vietnam as part of a monolithic big danger that was first of all going to threaten Southeast Asia and then ultimately Australia and then the United States itself. This turned out to be really untrue. A really key event in the build-up to the Vietnam War, and a key event to show the deceit of the government, was the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in 1964. The Johnson administration portrayed an attack, supposedly, against a U.S. ship in off the coast of North Vietnam as a deliberate and provocative attack, and used that to get support for the so-called Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which was a blank check by the Congress to give Johnson the authority to use whatever military force he thought fit in the Vietnam War. Well, the U.S. House of Representatives voted unanimously for this blank check resolution, and in the Senate, there were only two dissenting votes against this resolution, and one of them was cast by the U.S. Senator from Oregon, Wayne Morse, who at the time did not realize the deceit behind the resolution, but opposed it on constitutional grounds. And this is very important because the Constitution makes clear that only Congress has the right to declare war. The Constitution does not permit the president to just go to war on the basis of some blank check authorization by Congress in this way. And as it turned out, the portrayal of events behind the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was completely untrue. One of the incidents that was cited by the president didn't even happen, and the other was a very confused thing in the at night in which there was no deliberate attack. So the American public was deceived, and the Congress was stampeded into supporting a resolution that was unconstitutional and was a blank check support for war. Now, moving to the more to the present, a very similar resolution was passed by the Congress to authorize President Bush to go to attack Iraq, again, unconstitutional, in violation of U.S. Constitution. And again, we'll get into World War II, but this pattern of deceit by the presidential administration and then the stampeding of public opinion for war is one that we've seen time and again in American history.
I know there's a really eerie movie which I had an opportunity, it was almost blacklisted, and it eludes me, but it's about a very real scenario in which a war general decides that he's going to take over the reins of the President of the United States and run the country, and that becomes a very scary prospect in and of itself.
Well, there was you might be thinking of 5 Days in May.
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
It's a great movie. It's a pretty gripping movie, and it's I forget to hold the actors in it. But
that almost happened, though, at one point during that time.
Well,
anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, no, and well, now, I think we want to get examples about how this pattern is not just true of the Vietnam War or of the Iraq War, It's also true of the in the build-up to the American attack against Spain in 1898, in World War I, and, as you were referring to earlier, in World War II. Now, World War II is especially a problematic one because of all the wars America has been involved in, that's the one war that Americans are most inclined to think was a clear-cut battle between good and evil. Now, there's no question that Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan were evil, at least evil in many ways. Mm-hmm. But the United States was not directly threatened by these countries. But instead, the Roosevelt administration did everything in its power to falsely portray the reality internationally, to scare the American public, and to actually help create conditions for war that exploded, of course, with the attack against Pearl Harbor. And then, more noticeably, the Roosevelt administration did everything in its power to provoke war with Germany in 1940 and 41.
Now, that's the thing, is I remember hearing, you know, several times and even reading up into the point, and it even seems there, if you watch a movie like Tora, 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 Pearl Harbor, you know, as fictional as these may be with some facts, that somehow we really knew something big was going to happen with Japan attacking Pearl Harbor. Would you be able to elaborate on that?
Right. We publish a book. It's a reprint of a very good book entitled Pearl Harbor, The Story of the Secret War by George Morgenstern. This was a book that originally appeared in the 1947, a few years after the war, by an American writer who was a journalist and reporter and journalist for the Chicago Tribune. And he goes into great detail about what was known at the time. Now, many Americans have forgotten what was behind it, but the basic point he makes and lays out, I think, absolutely convincingly, is that the Roosevelt administration knew that an attack was coming against America by the Japanese. Now, I do not believe the evidence shows that Roosevelt knew that an attack specifically was coming at Pearl Harbor on December 7th. They expected more an attack against the U.S. Forces in the Philippines and expected an attack generally. The attack specifically against Pearl Harbor was a surprise in part because it was a very unprecedented and in its own way brilliant attack. The Japanese carried out the strike against the U.S. fleet in Pearl Harbor using airplanes and torpedoes in a way that had never been done before. And that's why there was a feeling that the ships that were stationed in Pearl Harbor could not be attacked because it would have involved an aerial attack that had never been mounted before. Having said that, the United States and Roosevelt administration had intercepted the Japanese diplomatic code, had broken the Japanese diplomatic code, and was aware that the Japanese were preparing an attack. And this is laid out, this was established even in the hearings that took place in the aftermath of the Pearl Harbor attack, and is laid out really in great detail in this book, Pearl Harbor, The Story of the Secret War. They knew that an attack was coming because the United States had broken the Japanese codes. But the Roosevelt administration had also given an ultimatum to Japan that put Japan in the position of having to choose between ruin as an industrial and modern power because it depended on the United States for petroleum, or making some sort of attack to break out of the stranglehold that the United States had imposed on Japan.
It just seems rather alarming that if we knew what was going on and Roosevelt decides to just go ahead and put us in harm's way, if you will, that was allowed to be happen, but yet then everybody was celebrating such patriotic duty about what almost seems like a deception there.
Yes. Well, I think that this goes to the core of how we view America and our place in the world. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult for Americans to accept that American troops have been sent to war and have died in vain. That's a very difficult thing to accept. It's a cliche. that people accept widely across the country that Americans fight for freedom. That our it's another way of saying that all of our wars are good wars. We don't really make mistakes in wars, because if you acknowledge that a war might have been avoided or that it was a mistake, it's another way of saying that those soldiers died in vain and didn't really die for freedom.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very, very difficult thing for many people to accept, especially a country like the United States, where an emphasis on moral rectitude is so important for the American character. Part of the reason for that, I think, is that America has never suffered the fate of just about every other country in the world of having been defeated in war or occupied or having bombs destroy our cities in warfare. So that we haven't suffered in the same way that other countries have. There's a kind of notion in America that good guys win wars and bad guys lose wars. And it's a simplistic and a wrong-headed one, and it makes us feel good because the United States has never been defeated in the way that Japan or France or Germany or Italy or Russia or whatever other countries have been defeated or occupied at one time or the other. And that's a difficult thing, I think, psychologically, and it's one of the things that characterizes the mentality and the mindset of Americans differently than the mindset and mentality of people in other countries.
You know, and that's so interesting because you think about after World War II that we needed to move into a new type of war, which was the Cold War of nuclear buildup with the Soviet Union versus the United States. So here you've got this perpetuating paranoia continuing. So it becomes pretty easy, depending on where people get their information from, to realize, well, I'm just going to have to believe what they're telling me here because I really don't have any measure to prove whether what they're saying is right or wrong.
Right. That's a very good point. And any healthy society requires that the public have at least a minimal level of confidence and trust in the political leadership of the country. If everybody's completely cynical, of course, things don't work very well. But on the other hand, I think that the record has shown Americans have been too naive and too trusting of our leadership. You know, that's why Vietnam was a shock to many Americans, because up until Vietnam and up until Watergate, I think the American public, far more than other countries and other peoples, had a very high level of trust in the presidency and a belief that the president that doesn't lie, the president tells the truth, our government tells the truth. That's why Vietnam was one of the reasons why Vietnam, I think, was such a shock and disillusionment for the American public. Now, we've had more shocks since then, Watergate, and then...
I don't know about shock. I'd call it more like cardiac arrest.
Well, cardiac arrest. And it's reached a high point, I think, with the... revelation that the pretext for the Iraq War was a lie. You know, what's more amazing to me is how is that the American public has not been more angry in calling Bush and Cheney and the rest of the Bush administration to account for having lied to the public. That's an extraordinary thing. I mean, to put it another way, if the leaders of other countries carry out wars on the basis of deceit like that, in some cases, we've executed their leaders for doing that. That's
right.
Considered a war crime. We executed leaders of Germany and Japan at the end of World War II for less deceit, I think, than the American leadership showed during the run-up to the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
But we're amazingly willing to forgive this kind of deceit, this kind of deception by the Bush administration that we would consider, you know, a crime when carried out by other countries.
You know, I think, too, when you take a look at the way information, especially with the Internet, is allowed to get to people, where there isn't a whole lot of ways people can police and block the truth from getting out, if that's what we want to call it here. What's fascinating when you bring up the war in Iraq is the fact that it wasn't even a year before the actual attack that, and it's on record, definitely, is that General Colin Powell said that Iraq is really a non-threat.
Right.
And here, less than a year, a little over a year, give or take, all of a sudden they've got weapons of mass destruction. You kind of sit there and go, now, wait a minute, something is really funky here.
That's a very good point. You know, many people have forgotten But just a few months before the U.S. attack, a number of very high-ranking retired U.S. military leaders testified in Congress before a congressional hearing advising against attacking Iraq. They spoke with a great deal of expertise. Those people who were familiar with the Middle East, who were familiar with the Iraq situation, were almost universally, I mean, not almost, were universally cautioning against attacking Iraq. And it was only the Bush administration and the neocons that were beating the drums for war in this way against the advice of people who lived in, understood, and were familiar with the Middle East and familiar with the Iraq situation. It's fantastic, really. I mean, one of the most amazing features to me is how the Saddam Hussein regime was so demonized as this morally horrible regime and dangerous one, considering that it was a regime that, during the Reagan administration, the United States had supported in its war against Iran.
Uh-huh.
And similarly, the huge rhetoric against the Soviet Union in the 1950s and 60s contrasts with the pro-Soviet propaganda and pro-Soviet stance of the United States during World War II. Remember, the World War II was won first and foremost militarily, not by the United States, but by the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Something like 3/5 of the German divisions destroyed in World War II were destroyed on the Eastern Front by the Red Army, which was an enormous military force. And during the war, to put it another way, America's most important military ally in World War II was the Soviet Union. And its record as a regime was simply ignored by the United States during World War II and excused. And then after the war, the very country that was our most important ally in World War II was then portrayed as a morally horrible regime we had to oppose after the war was over.
It's just crazy sometimes, you know, and knowing this, it's like, what do we then do so that we can quit, I guess, walking in a fog, believing that our leaders, we can just trust what they have to say and we'll just do what they want us to do.
Yes, that's right. And that's a dangerous thing, because when the leadership of a society, our political leadership, is so such, it shows such failure of doing what is right rather than just going along with the flow, you might say, that's a very terrible thing. And that means then that when the leadership is that that much of a failure, it's incumbent, it's imperative that people in the public take the lead and speak out against those things. Mm-hmm. And that's why I cite the 1964 Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. Only two members of the entire U.S. Congress, House and Senate, voted against this unconstitutional and deceitful resolution giving blank check authorization to President Johnson to go to war. Only two. And that's why Wayne Morse, I think, deserves a permanent place in the memory of the American public for standing by principle. He was very viciously attacked for taking that stand. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it was considered just almost treasonous for Wayne Morse and for others to speak out against the Vietnam War in something like the same way that to oppose the Iraq War was considered by many people to be treasonous, to be as if you're excusing 9/11, even though there was no relationship.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's also interesting, too, when you talk about people who stand against the grain, is I found it interesting with the war in Iraq that up until just before it started, you heard and seen General Colin Powell in the news. As it started and continued, he just seemed to fall off the radar as though, and it's just my opinion or perception, as though he knew we were doing something wrong and he didn't want to have any part of it.
Well, Colin Powell even admitted that, not very explicitly, but he
right.
later... He
but
later,
just his action showed you that he was thinking there's something really wrong here.
Well, Colin Powell, in the run-up to the U.S. invasion, went before the United Nations to try to give a presentation to justify attacking Iraq. And he showed videos and so forth. Even at the time, I was amazed at how weak the whole presentation was. For example, he would show a picture of a truck and claim that it was a truck for biological warfare. Well, there's no way of checking. It's just a truck. You don't know what's inside, really. But the point
there's an ostrich with a Scud missile around its neck.
Right. Later, you might remember, Colin Powell publicly said that presentation at the United Nations to justify the war against Iraq was his most shameful moment, the most shameful thing he ever did. And he said that. And in fact, it was. It was a very shameful thing. He became a propagandist of deceitful propaganda for the Bush administration. And he was specifically chosen to make that presentation to the United Nations because he was a man who carried a lot more credibility than Bush himself or any high-ranking person immediately in the administration. But just because, I mean, Colin Powell not only had a record in the military and made a good presence, he allowed himself to be, misused in that way. And as I mentioned, he even publicly later acknowledged his shameful role in justifying that attack.
You know, I find what makes all of this so fascinating is that we do live in a world now where people have access to all the information it seems they'll ever need about anything, whether it's about a neighbor that's over in Turkey or whether it's about, you know, a family that's in the Soviet Union. It really doesn't matter. It seems that because of the Internet, we're connected more than ever to see and know exactly what is going on. You take a look at the Y2K crisis. And that was probably one of the most interesting times just because at that single moment, everybody was consciously aware of, will something happen? So now we take a look at, for instance, war and warfare, and people are beginning to wake up to say, well, this seems to be about oil and natural resources and the exploitation of labor around the world. And you're starting to see more and more about, you know, the banking industry itself, World Bank, IMF, and how they're setting up people to just basically become slaves. And for a lot of people at first, it sounds like a lot of conspiracy thinking. But let's take a look at how people, for instance, through the history, especially, and I want to cite just two examples. One is the war in Iraq, and the other is the Vietnam War. It was in 1967 that we had the March on Washington. Okay, that was the time that the United States had said, we have told you we don't want to be in this war. And if you're going to be in it, then you're going to be doing it against our wishes. What do? They just continue with the war as though the United States or the citizens of the United States just didn't matter. War in Iraq, true story. In New York City, 500,000 or more people marched against the war in Iraq. Yet little to no media coverage was given to that particular feat. Now think about that. 500,000 people in the streets of New York City, and hardly anybody ever heard about this. It kind of makes you wonder, can we ever regain control of our government to say, you know, enough is enough?
You raise a very, very good point, Daniel. I think something has changed. I am very mindful that in the months just before the attack against Iraq, not only in the United States, but also around the world, there were enormous demonstrations against the war, against the attack, the impending attack. And public opinion did play a role strong enough to get the German government to switch from support for the war to opposition to it. Now, having said that, I think definitely something has really changed with the because of the Internet. Remember, in the 1960s, during the Vietnam War, news in the United States and information was essentially funneled through just three television networks and two major newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the three big television networks, NBC, CBS, and ABC. Today, that's no longer the case. There's much more information available. And if the Internet had existed during the time of the Vietnam War, Americans would have had access to reporting in British and French and European, other sources that they didn't have at that time. And today, there's far more information about Iraq and now about the danger of a war with Iran that was able to be suppressed during the Vietnam War, and also the lag time between a government carrying out a campaign and the awareness that the pretexts are false has gotten shorter and shorter. It's largely due to the Internet, in fact, I think, mm-hmm. that the deceit of the Bush administration in the Iraq War is now universally acknowledged, is now universally understood. It took a longer time for there to be public wide awareness about the deceit behind the Vietnam War. But now it's information is just far, far more available to the public. The big danger now, I think, Daniel, is the danger of a war against Iran. And the around the world, there is universal opposition to an attack against Iran by the United States or by Israel. And there's a lot of realization, I think, of the real facts of the matter. And if the situation with regard to Iran was like it was during the Vietnam War, the public, I think, would have been would be much more easily stampeded into supporting a war than is the case now.
Now, what do you think about the current administration? You're saying there seems to be a real threat with a war in Iran. Why is this for maybe our listeners who aren't so clear about what's going on there?
Well, to put it in a nutshell, the justification or the support for attacking Iran is based on the notion that Iran might build a nuclear weapon. Iran hasn't even built a nuclear reactor. Not even, not even that. Many countries, of course, have nuclear reactors without having nuclear weapons.
Sure.
And Iran is a signatory on the International Atomic Energy Non-Proliferation Treaty on the use of nuclear power. And their places are inspected and so forth. But we have the United States has good relations, or at least tolerable relations, with countries that aren't even that completely ignore the Non-Proliferation Treaty. I'm thinking specifically of Pakistan and Israel. Both of those countries have nuclear weapons in violation International Atomic Energy Agency rules and the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But we overlook that. But in the case of Iran, which doesn't even have a nuclear reactor yet, the claim is that they're so untrustworthy that we will have to attack them or will be obliged to attack them if they even build a nuclear reactor. Now, even if Iran was to build a nuclear reactor, and even if they were to build nuclear weapons, that's a long way from being any kind of threat to the United States. But anyway, that's the discussion going on right now. And around the world, there is universal opposition to this idea of going to war against Iraq. The outgoing chairman of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed El-Baradei, has said repeatedly, and others, and the United States admits, Iran has no nuclear weapons program that anybody can. There's no evidence of that. There's no danger of that. But the people who are in favor of war have been continually insisting that Iran is so dangerous that we have got to attack them if they even build a nuclear reactor.
I find it interesting that in the course of the 6 years we've been doing the Beyond 50 radio program, one of the elements or things we like to bring in is travel around the world from a very unique perspective. And what I have heard consistently, and this is no kidding, from United States citizens who travel around the world, they felt that the United States was more dangerous than countries such as Iran and Iraq to visit.
Yes.
And
well,
I found that really interesting that that's how they view. They love the citizens of the United States, but they can't stand our government.
Yeah.
Now, what then do we do?
It's very difficult because the arrogance built into our policies is so entrenched. I'll just give one example.
Mm-hmm.
The United if China, for example, was to build a military base in Mexico, this country would go berserk. They'd be screaming and yelling about the danger to the United States. Well, the United States has military bases in more than 100 countries around the world. You know, there's all this talk about the danger of Iran building a nuclear weapon. Well, consider the situation from Iran's point of view. Its neighbors include on one side, includes Afghanistan, which is occupied by the United States, a military power. Another neighbor in the region, Pakistan, has nuclear weapons. India has nuclear weapons. Israel has nuclear weapons. On the other side of Iran is Iraq, which is occupied by the United States, also nuclear power. It would be astonishing if Iran was to say, we're not going to have nuclear weapons, considering how everybody else in the region either has them or is occupied by countries that do have them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but we hold other countries to a standard we don't hold ourselves. The United States has military bases all around the world, and we talk in a very easy way about the right to impose our way of life or the way we think governments ought to be all around the world. Now, part of the reason I think of this is that our foreign policy is a reflection of our domestic policy. That is, our foreign policy is a reflection of our kind of notion that we're a good country and that just as we can turn people from all over the world into good Americans, we can turn other countries into good America. And we've done this over and over. You know, it's an odd thing that that many people seem to think that the danger of war comes most from American presidents who were Republicans. But the record is at least as great of war carried out by American presidents who are Democratic. I'm thinking of Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson, most obviously. This isn't a partisan thing. It has to do with something about, I think, the American character and the American heritage that is fairly unique to the United States. It comes from our own background. It's a kind of arrogance, this arrogance that this is a good country, that we can transform people by the amazing powers of the United States, not only domestically, but also internationally.
Now, you did write an essay, The Good War, Myth of World War II and Why It's Dangerous. Now, tell us what the importance of that is for people as they listen to the show today and how they might be able to access to be able to read that.
The basic point, the essay is on our website, ihr.org. The basic point of the essay is to puncture this myth that World War II or other wars are clear-cut battles or conflicts between good and evil. It's not that simple. During World War II, the most important allies of the United States was the Soviet Union, which was the most tyrannical regime in the world at the time, and the British Empire, which was the most important imperialist country in the world at the time. It's not true that on the one side were all these good, freedom-loving, peaceful, egalitarian states, and on the other side were bad, militaristic, oppressive states. It's much more complicated than that. Now, I focus especially on World War II because that's the war that, when all is said and done, people say, well, that's the one time we were on the good side. Remember, as I said earlier, America's most important military ally in World War II was the Soviet Union. Stalin killed far more people than Hitler did, and we that's more or less universally acknowledged right now. But during World War II, that was our major military ally, and the American government justified and supported its alliance with the Soviet Union. But the lesson I try to draw from this is about the dangers of going to war. Wars almost never turn out the way people expect when they start them. Iraq has turned out very differently than our leaders expected when they began this war. Vietnam turned out very differently. World War II turned out very differently than people expected. World War I ended very differently than our leaders had projected when we got into that war. And so war itself is a horrible thing. War is and it should be entered into only after every other possibility is exhausted. And that's not what we did in almost all the wars the United States has been involved in.
I also find it funny, or let's just say odd, for instance, that John Fitzgerald Kennedy decided to build the U.S. military to such a huge size that we would be too afraid to use it, and it seems to have basically taken over our economy.
Well, it's an odd thing, and this is now pretty widely acknowledged by historians. When Kennedy was running for president in 1960, he claimed that one of the reasons he wanted to be president was that the Republican administration of Eisenhower had permitted what he called a dangerous missile gap, that we had fallen way behind the Soviet Union in our nuclear missile capability. In fact, it wasn't true. The United States was vastly more powerful had a vastly more larger arsenal of nuclear weapons and missiles than the Soviet Union. But Kennedy made a big point when he was running for president about how the danger of the United States becoming weak vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. And but this mentality is pretty well ingrained. And even during the Vietnam War, Kennedy gave conflicting signals, but he accepted in interviews and in statements this false notion of the so-called domino theory, that if Vietnam fell to communism, then Thailand and the rest of Southeast Asia, and then all of Asia would fall to communism and we'd be threatened. In fact, the whole premise was wrong. Shortly after the Vietnam War ended, Vietnam and China went to war against each other, because nationalism is a far more potent force in the world than communism. And we've seen that over and over, just like nationalism is a more powerful force than Islam. People talk right now about Islamic fascism, but in fact, there isn't anything like this unity of Muslims as those people who talk about this danger like to pretend.
Now, there's also a bigger war that sometimes goes unheard of, and that certainly is our political body and how they support our military who have actually served. It's really very sad to see what happens here. Good people go because they're told to go. They felt that it was their duty to become to be in the United States military to defend and protect our values and our standard of living. A lot of times you'll see them go and they all of a sudden see this illusion they went into kind of dissipate, but they still do their duty because they're required to.
Yes.
Some of them suffer catastrophic losses, even up to and including amputated souls.
Yes.
And it's almost as though they're just thrown in the garbage and forgot about. And I don't see anything patriotic about that. Having served in the United States Navy myself, it was just atrocious to see what was happening, and we weren't even in a war back in the early 80s outside of bombing Baghdad.
Well, I gave a talk at the University of Oregon about a year ago, and in the audience I was talking again about war and dangers of war, and one of the questions was from a woman in a wheelchair. She said that she had lost her legs in a bombing attack in Iraq. She was serving with the U.S. military in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
and she asked the question, why did I lose my legs? Why am I here? Well, it's very, very painful. It's a very, very sad and touching thing. I mean, every person who acts out of idealism or courage deserves respect, because idealism and courage are virtues. They're virtues even when they're in the service of a false or misguided or deceitful cause. And it's a very, very sad thing when the idealism, the patriotism, the dedication of young men and women is exploited by political leaders to the point that they send young men to their deaths or cause them to be blinded or lose their arms and legs, destroying their futures and their hopes. That's a terrible, terrible thing. And it's one of the reasons why I'm much more angry at George Bush or Cheney I wish more people were more angry at the terrible things that these men have done. And I'm disappointed that there's not more anger and more desire and more demand that they be held accountable for what they did.
I know that Vincent Bugliosi, who was the prosecuting attorney in the Charles Manson case, had wrote a book, and we had him on our program. It was The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. And I've actually put this book out to certain people, just say, you know, take a look and read this. And they say there's an overwhelming sadness because how throughout the book he talks about individual lives of people who served and, you know, was this war really necessary and how we went under false pretenses into the war. And as you take a look at world, or at least United States history, you know, in wars, it seems to be a very consistent thing. We're going to send you in there, you know, you're going to do your duty to protect the country. But once you're done and you're not 6 feet under, we're done with you. And you think, where's the protection in that?
Yes, yes, that's right. Yeah, well, every war is so terrible, creates such horrible suffering, death, loss of life. And that's something that I think, unfortunately, many Americans don't fully appreciate, because we haven't had wars fought on our territory. I lived in Europe for several years, and I was very moved by how Europeans overwhelmingly have a very, very strong aversion to war because Europe suffered so terribly in the First and Second World Wars. And I mean this across the board, whether people are French or German, Italian, Polish, Russian. They knew first and foremost about the horrors, the catastrophe, the destruction of war. Americans don't have that sense. For Americans, wars are things that take place far, far away in countries that we're hardly familiar with. We don't have an imminent sense, an intimate sense of the destruction and horrors of war in the way that many other peoples have had, the Japanese or Russians or Chinese and so forth. And that's why we tend to exaggerate our own suffering. Now, 9/11 was a terrible thing, but I remember there was an interview with the former Chancellor of Germany, Helmut Schmidt, shortly after the 9/11 attack. And he said, okay, yes, it's terrible. You lost several thousand people in that attack. He said, I'm from the city of Hamburg in Germany. On one night in 1943, 20,000 people in Hamburg were killed in Allied bombing raids. And he said, keep this in perspective. Yes, it's terrible, but one shouldn't overreact to these things. One should keep this in perspective. But America reacted, I think overreacted, in part because it was so unprecedented, because we hadn't had something like that happen in the United States. Mm-hmm. And other countries have a more, I think, realistic sense about the cost of war because they're something they've experienced firsthand in a way that we Americans have not.
Well, that's certainly agreed there. So it takes us to, I would believe, a final point, and that is what to do now. Here I was a young boy, just like other young boys, going in grade school and learning history and about how great the United States is, which, in my opinion, the American ideal or experiment is still one of the greatest things ever created. The idea that you can grow and be free to express yourself and to live life on your terms, of course, abiding by the law reasonably. But the thing is that we were taught in school about the greatness of our country, especially when it comes to war. And it's interesting as you get older and you realize, you know, there are some things that just aren't true about what I learned in history. For instance, Christopher Columbus, you know, and you take a look at war in and of itself and you start to have a disillusion about what it means to be patriotic and what it means to be American when you discover that we tend to get ourselves in situations we have no business in, sort of pushing people around. And I'm sure there are a lot of people that just don't like bullies. Is that an area that we start? Where do we begin to start so that perhaps our history has actually taught us something to take the right actions for our future?
You raised a very good point, I think. Yeah, I think it's particularly our generation that's the very disillusioned one, because mm-hmm. among younger people today, people that are in their teens or 20s, there's a very large, widespread cynicism that's really alarming, I think. And the generation older than ours, I think, was too trusting. The one thing I would stress probably in that regard is to keep in mind the advice of the founding fathers. They stressed that although America should be a champion of freedom and liberty, it shouldn't go beyond its borders to slay dragons in other countries. We should first and foremost be concentrating on making our society as good a one as we can, as an example, as a model to others, and not go around trying to impose our way of life or our values on other societies, even if we're right. It's an arrogant thing to do and a dangerous thing to do. And we've veered far away, moved far away from the advice of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams, and many others who warned against all of this. And also I would bring up in that regard the warning of Dwight Eisenhower in his farewell address.
Mm-hmm.
In which he warned about the grave dangers of the military-industrial complex in our society and the power that it will gain, either sought or unsought. And these are words that bear repeating and bear keeping in mind today, I think, for all of us. And we're all going to see now what the new administration of Barack Obama is going to do. I'm encouraged and hopeful about what he said so far, but the actions of the Obama administration have so far been been disappointing. But we'll, I think, like all of us, the listeners and you and I and so forth, we're hopeful that he will draw good lessons from these disappointments of the past.
Yeah, it's time for all of us just to settle down and have a beer.
Well,
I certainly appreciate you being on our program. It's interesting because I'll have some friends who get into the conspiracy thinking, and then others it's like, well, let's just take a look at the facts as well as we know them and present them. And mainly it's our goal on the show here to get people thinking again and to look into matters for their own so that they can be compelled to be involved in a decision that moves in the right direction rather than a deceived one. And we appreciate you for being on our program today. Could you go ahead and give out a website people can find out more?
Yeah, the website address is IHR.org. And the Institute for Historical Review, of which I'm the director, is focuses on the background, the origins, and the course of conflict and wars in history. But we try to emphasize historical issues that have relevance here today to understand the backstory, the background mm-hmm. of the conflicts of our present time, and to learn from similar events in history to try to understand how best to deal with those problems in our world today.
Well, Mark Weber, again, thank you for being here on the Beyond 50 radio program. It's been a pleasure to not only come on and honor our veterans in the right way, but also honor it with good information that you did serve. We're very proud of you, and hopefully, you know, you'll have a good, long, peace, life, and prosper. But sometimes when you do a show like this, it gets a little sketchy to think, well, then you're trying to say what I did was wrong. It's like, no, that's not what's going on here. And I think people, because of Vietnam, woke up to the war in Iraq and said, it isn't the army, the military that we're upset with. It's the choices that are being made that put them in an unnecessary harm's way in many ways.
Yes, thank you, Daniel. Well put. Well put. I agree.
Well, thank you again for being on the program, Mark.
And thank you again for having me on.
You bet. So we want to also thank you, the listeners out there, for tuning in. You're listening to the Beyond 50 radio program. I also want to thank one of our following people for making this program possible, and that is the Tree of Life Rejuvenation Center. About 25% of Americans over the age of 60 have type 2 diabetes. It's a condition many believe to be irreversible. Dr. Gabriel Cousins is the founder of the Tree of Life Rejuvenation Center, which offers a 21-day reversing diabetes naturally program, which is medically supervised. Just imagine the freedom of no longer living with the disease. As an example, a 76-year-old man with type 2 diabetes went on the program. By the second day, his blood sugar dropped from 224 to the mid-80s, where it has remained. His wife also did the program, and together they switched on to a whole new level of joy, health, and vitality in their relationship. Join the Tree of Life family that is located within a majestic valley in Arizona to experience transformative whole person wellness. Simply call 520-394-2520. That's 520-394-2520, or visit them online at treeoflife.nu. Again, thank you for tuning in. I'm Daniel Davis. You've been listening to the Beyond 50 radio program. Also, be sure to visit us at our website at beyond50radio.com and sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter. That is the number 50 with a 50. Thanks again for tuning in. Remember, live your day past halfway.